This term, we'll be looking at three psychological phenomena
that have a lot in common, three different psychoanalytic concepts. The notion of screen memories
in week three,
the notion of object choice
in week five,
and the notion of transference
in week nine.
They're all three of them forms of repetition. And indeed, in talking about the transference, Freud produces a phrase which was to become the name of a leading concept at the in the end of his life, the compulsion to repeat. And that we'll be looking at that
in week 9 and 10.
And we're looking at the death drive, the theory of the death drive. But the concept, compulsion to repeat, is first formulated in talking about the transference. Now, the clinical and theoretical problems that have generated these terms and concepts go right back to the very beginning, to the trauma stuff we looked at the beginning of last term. And Freud's essay that I want to start by talking about, the screen memory essay, comes right out of that question about the relation between memory and fantasy. Okay, as he moves away from a very simple, straightforward model of trauma and of traumatic memory, to the notion that certain traumatic memories can only ever be accessed via fantasy derivatives. They never appear as such in obvious or transparent form. And he evolves the notion of a screen memory. And in a rather fascinating analysis, an extended analysis of one instance of the memory, the screen memory, you get him enacting a logical kind of parabola in which he begins by addressing a minority phenomenon, this unusual subset of childhood memories that most of us have probably at least one example of, okay? And that ends up implying or a critique of the whole category of childhood memories as such and their claims to sort of transparency or kind of or truth, as it were. And I want to spend the first part of the lecture working through that essay. I'm going to be slightly more formal, as I was with the Hamlet lecture at the end of last term, because I've been writing about this stuff in a book, so I've got some formulated sort of thoughts and arguments here. Okay, so I'm going to start with screen memories. In May 1899, Freud sent off for periodical publication his paper on screen memories, where the concept is first formulated, and it emerges directly out of this struggle within the fantasy memory relation in the 1890s in his thinking, and particularly in the Letters to Fleece, to articulate these two terms, memory and fantasy, in a way that isn't just a banal mutual opposition between them. And he begins the essay with affirming the power of the prehistoric in individual history. Quote, that the experience of the earliest years of our childhood leave ineradicable traces in the depths of our minds, unquote. That's on page 303 at the beginning of the essay. However, these experiences that leave such traces are not represented as such directly in the archives of conscious memory. The outcome of a direct interrogation of our store of memories is often disappointing. Quotes, either nothing at all, this is from the earliest moments, or a relatively small number of isolated recollections, which are often dubious or of enigmatic importance, unquote. So continuous memory of a connected chain of events begins only roughly with the sixth or seventh year, and often quite late as the tenth year, leaving what only a year before in a letter to Fleece he had called, quote, the crucial prehistoric period of individual life, which is the source of the unconscious and alone contains the etiology, the causation process of the psychoneuroses, lost in the obscurity of what he calls a general infantile amnesia. It would appear that the general rule for adult memory, that emotionally significant experiences are retained and able to be recollected, does not obtain for the earliest years, where so much disappears. Consequently, Freud addresses the enigmatic phenomenon of, I quote, people whose earliest recollections of childhood are concerned with everyday and indifferent events, which could not produce any emotional effect, even in children, but which are recollected, too clearly, one is inclined to say, in every detail, while approximately contemporary events to them, even if on the evidence of their parents they were moved intensely by those events at the time, have not been retained in memory. So this is a puzzle, an enigma about the childhood memories of childhood. Focusing on this common subspecies of memory, then, the vividly recalled childhood scene, which appears to lack emotional significance or any reason for its retention, let alone for its clarity or for its sensory intensity, Freud elaborates an account that ends up calling into question the veridical transparency of all childhood memories. Drawing on research done in 1895 by V.N.C. Henri, based on responses by 123 subjects to a questionnaire about their earliest memories, Freud cites as an exemplary instance of these enigmatic early scenes that of a professor of philology whose earliest memory from his fourth year was that of a table set for a meal with a basin of ice on it. And that's all. This coincided with the death of a much-loved grandmother, which had distressed him greatly at the time, but of which he has no recollection at all. He's told about it by his parents. Another man repeats his earliest memory as a scene in which he breaks off a branch from a tree in the presence of other people, one of whom helped him. Quotes, "He thinks he can still identify the spot where it happened," unquote. If the enigmatic childhood scene is then, in Freud's metaphor, a torso with missing limbs, then its restoration will show that it does obey the rule of adult memories and that the most important experiences are retained, Freud will claim. As we have seen in the letters to Fliess on the memory-fantasy relation, the model Freud increasingly deployed to understand these mysterious and only apparently arbitrary fragments of memory is the one he had recently developed to analyze both dreams and symptoms. And he summarizes this model as, quote, one, conflict, two, repression, three, substitution involving a compromise between opposing forces. It's a model that goes back to his earliest account of pathological defense in hysteria in the Project for Scientific Psychology, which we considered in week one last term. There, schematically, an experience composed of two elements, A plus B, is fragmented such that the innocuous element A takes the place of the emotionally charged element B. Quote, "The hysteric who weeps at A is quite unaware that he is doing so because of the association A-B, and B itself plays no part at all in his conscious life." Okay, he weeps over A, but it's because of an element of the experience B that he does not remember or has no consciousness of. The enigmatic childhood memory is shown to exemplify the same psychical mechanism then as this excessively intense idea, quote unquote, over which the hysteric unaccountably and puzzlingly weeps, as do the symptoms of obsessional neurosis and paranoia, and as well the non-pathological phenomenon of dreaming. However, the model of a simple substitution of A for B has been further complicated by the notion of a compromise formation that results from a conflict of mental forces in which neither cancels out the other, but both continue. Quote, "Instead, a compromise is brought about somewhat on the analogy of the resultant in a parallelogram of forces." Have I got something to draw this on the board? It's not exactly a parallelogram. What I'm remembering from school physics... if a block of wood is moving along at a certain speed, okay, and something on a different trajectory comes down and hits it, if it not hit it, it would just continue along that path. If this hadn't intersected with that, it would have continued along that path. Instead, what results is something like that, a compromise between... It's not exactly a parallelogram, but it's my memory of that diagram from school physics. In other words, a compromise resultant in which the power of the two forces is still operating, but the trajectories they would have taken, right, is not manifest. Okay. And that's a really pretty straightforward model of a compromise formation. In the conflict between the force that seeks to, quote, fix important impressions by establishing reproducible memory images, and the resistance to that force, What results is not a direct reproduction of the experience in question, but an image which is to some degree associatively displaced from it, just as the actual trajectory of the block that is thrown off course, okay, is displaced from the trajectory it would have taken. It will lack the emotionally significant but disturbing elements that provoke the resistance to memory, and hence it will appear trivial or insignificant. But with its sensory elements phantasmatically enhanced and intensified. Its retention in memory is due not to its content, but to its relation with the disturbing elements that have been excluded. Freud cites the old saying about counterfeits, like a false gold ring or something, that, quote, they're not made of gold themselves, but have lain beside something that is made of gold. As Freud himself remarks, this schematic representation of the screen memory turns on what contemporary language we would call a metonymical relationship of displacement by contiguity, making use of two elements from a contemporaneous or a simultaneous ensemble, as in the A to B, A and B schema. However, this forecloses, cuts out, the temporal dimension, which is so crucial to the process of afterwardsness that we've talked about as governing trauma, the temporality of trauma, Freud's word Nachträglichkeit, afterwardsness, which Strachey translates, remember, as deferred action. This, nevertheless, returns with all its problems in the example of the screen memory Freud gives. As is obvious from a knowledge of Freud's biography, and especially from his dream material in the interpretation of dreams, and as well as from the Fleece letters, the clinical example of a screen memory that is analysed at length in this essay in the form of a Socratic dialogue with a fictionalised patient is, in fact, based on Freud's own personal memories. Okay, so there are kind of two Freuds in the essay. The dialogue takes place then between Freud the analyst and the undisclosed or disguised Freud the analysand, who we are told is, quote, not at all or only very slightly neurotic, unquote. And this enables Freud to dramatise something of the oscillations that have characterised his theoretical struggles in the 1890s, as we've followed them in some of the weeks of last term. As Nick Rand and Maria Turok, whose work we'll be looking at in a few weeks' time, comment on this essay, the essay is a dramatisation of an internal debate of Freud's, as in a play, two interlocutors represent opposed points of view. What is at stake here in this clinical dialogue is the temporal structure of the memory-fantasy relation. And although it is not acknowledged as such, the word doesn't appear as such in the essay, what is at stake is the logic of afterwardsness, as it has governed the model of the trauma. What has plagued Freud in the framework of the seduction theory was both the status to be given to certain focal scenes, were they memory, were they fantasy, and the relation between early moments and later moments in the dialectic of afterwardsness. Despite a tendency to polarise, in some of his essays, the priority of the early scene as the site of memory over against the priority of the later scene as the moment of back projection and retrospective fantasy, we have traced, I think in some of the texts we looked at, a richer and more complex understanding of their mutual interdependence rather than polarised opposition. For the logic of afterwardsness had entailed the inscription of an excess, a surplus of disturbing excitation that had resisted integration and binding into the ego and its archives in the experience of trauma. And this was reactivated and reworked in later moments. Its paradox was, the paradox of trauma, was the notion of powers emanating, I'm quoting here, the notion of powers emanating from a memory image, which were in fact absent from the real impression. Right? A notion of powers emanating from a memory image that were in fact absent from the real impression. It was not the immediate or direct result, the traumatic effect was not the immediate or direct result of either the earlier infantile or the later adult scenes. That could explain the hysterical symptoms, but a composite image. You could call it a memorial fantasy or a phantasmatic memory. And it derived from both earlier and later scenes simultaneously, a kind of hybrid formation. Freud approaches this again in the form of the screen memory, which he explicitly compares with the hysterical symptom. Unfortunately, the essay to some extent is a bit of a missed encounter But nevertheless, I think a very valuable one to follow through. Now, briefly, the enigmatic memory that Freud, the analysand, presents stages a lush meadow full of yellow dandelions where three children, the young Freud, inverted commas, and two cousins, a boy and a girl, are playing and gathering flowers. The little girl has the best bunch, so the two boys, quote, fall on her and snatch away her flowers, unquote. She runs in tears up the meadow to a cottage where a peasant woman gives her a big slice of black bread and butter. The two boys throw away their flowers and run up, demanding to be given some bread too. Quote, the peasant woman cuts the loaf with a long knife. In my memory, the bread tastes quite delicious, unquote. So Freud, the patient, comments that there is, quite, something not quite right about the scene, unquote, that he recalls, such as the intensity of the yellow of the flowers and the taste of the bread, which seemed to me exaggerated, he says, in an almost hallucinatory fashion. End quote. Now, one of the functions of the dialogue between Freud the analyst and Freud the analysand is to accommodate an emphasis on both early and later moments, to give them each their due, as it were. The analysis begins by establishing that the memory, as distinct from the scene remembered, does not itself date back to early childhood, but was first awoken at the age of 17, when Freud, in inverted commas, was visiting the rural scenes that feature in the memory, and he was experiencing his first love. This gave rise to a set of fantasies, quote, that were not concerned with the future, but whose aim was to improve the past. Their aim was to improve the past. And it centred on the 15-year-old daughter of the old family friends he was staying with, marriage to whom represented to him an alternative, happier life history than the one that had followed his family's departure from the country to the city due to the collapse of his father's business. He went bankrupt. He comments, quote, I can remember quite well for what a long time afterwards it was that I was affected by the yellow colour of the dress she was wearing when we first met, whenever I saw that same colour elsewhere, unquote. This clearly signals retrospective fantasy as the driving force in the production of the memory. 3 years later, at the age of 20, Freud, in inverted commas, revisits the now grown-up cousins, that is to say, the boy and the girl, who figured as children in the memory. Here he does not fall into love with his female cousin from the childhood scene, as he had with the girl in the visit to his old family friends 3 years earlier, but rather his uncle and his father plan a possible marriage between the two of them that would involve Freud giving up his studies at university and joining his uncle's successful business, becoming a businessman. The fantasy shared by both the fathers, as well as the son's earlier fantasy, falling in love with the girl from the old family friends 3 years earlier, quote, aimed to make good the loss in which the original catastrophe, family bankruptcy, moving to the city, an impoverished existence in the city, had involved my whole existence as a child, unquote. Freud, the analyst, pinpoints the amalgamation of these two later fantasies. Marrying the girl in the yellow dress, associated with the chain dark yellow alpine flowers, light yellow lowland flowers, yellow dandelions in the memory scene, that's fantasy one, and marrying his cousin and joining the family business, exchanging the flowers of his academic interests for the prosperous bread and butter occupation in his uncle's business. That's fantasy two. And Freud the analyst tells Freud the analysand, quote, you projected the two fantasies onto one another and made a childhood memory out of them, unquote. The screen memory thus constructed represents the fantasies of a later date through symbolic and associative connections, both metaphoric connections of analogy and metonymic connections of contiguity or adjacency. And his alter ego replies back to the analyst, quote, but if that is so, there was no childhood memory, but only a fantasy that was put back into childhood. And a feeling tells me that the scene is genuine, he says to his analyst. Two issues are at stake here. The familiar one of the authenticity of memory as against its retrospective construction, and the question of motive. Why was it necessary to represent adult or adolescent fantasies by childhood scenes? What drove that transformation? And especially if the fantasies, or at least one of them, had the stamp of paternal approval. You know, why did it have to be repressed and only represented symbolically? The reply to the latter involves the explication of a sexual dimension to the innocent early scene. The taking of flowers from the girl, the two boys fell on her and snatched away her flowers, makes use of the traditional symbolism of deflowering to represent a sexual wish. This sexual fantasy is the prolongation of the conscious one of marrying into an approved past and prosperous present, but one that has to remain unconscious because, and I quote, the dominating mood of diffidence and of respect towards the girl kept it suppressed. So it remains unconscious. It slips away into a childhood memory. It is precisely the coarsely sensual element in the fantasy which explains why it did not develop into a conscious fantasy, but must be content to find its way elusively and under a flowery disguise into a childhood scene. And Freud the analyst formulates this as a general principle, and I quote, the slipping away of repressed thoughts and wishes into childhood memories happens invariably with historical patients, he says. And he adds that there is always some pleasurable motive for the recall of the remote past, the remobilization of a childhood scene. So we have the potential theory of remembrance as wish fulfillment, which would be parallel to dreaming as wish fulfillment. At this point, the essay appears to be firmly aligned with the retrospective fantasy that dates from the position of retrospective fantasy that dates from the September 1897 letter of repudiation of the seduction theory that we've looked at last term, and the much more recent letter that I quoted from at the beginning, prioritizing the prehistoric. As a result, Freud, the alter ego, the analysand, responds to Freud, the analyst, I cannot help concluding that what I am dealing with is something that never happened at all now, but has been unjustifiably smuggled in among my childhood memories. This allows the official Freud to take up once again the claims of the prehistoric and the infantile, and I quote, I see that I must take up again the defense of the memory's genuineness. You are going too far. Suppose now that this slipping away into childhood scenes cannot occur unless there is a memory trace, the content of which offers the adult fantasy a point of contact, comes, as it were, halfway to meet it. Once a point of contact of this kind has been found, in the present instance it was the deflowering, the taking away of the flowers, the remaining content of the fantasy is remodeled with the help of every legitimate intermediate idea that it can make contact with, taking the bread, for example, till it finds points of contact with the childhood scene. Unquote. So Freud's defense of the genuineness of the childhood scene points to both the potentials within it for meeting the adult fantasy halfway, as well as to its resistance to being simply made over by the later fantasy. Certain details of the scene don't quite fit, the presence of the boy cousin, the peasant woman and the nurse, and there is this signal, the hallucinatory intensity of the yellow flowers and the taste of the bread, which signal the presence of a phantasmatic pleasure. Now, what is striking about this account is that despite the parallel of the screen memory with the dream and as a form of wish fulfillment, Freud's defense of the genuineness of the childhood scene actually reverses his model of the dream. And I'll explain it this way. With the dream, a recent wish only leads to a dream if that recent wish is a derivative of a prehistoric one and can get itself adopted by the childhood, the earlier childhood or infantile wish, unquote. That's from a letter to Fleece. While the screen memory of the childhood scene is merely the delegate of the organizing fantasy that comes from the later period. Despite its genuineness, it is merely raw material that was utilizable. Otherwise, quote, it would not have been possible for this particular memory, rather than any others, to make its that way forward into consciousness. Freud's assumption here seems to be both that the childhood experience is inscribed somewhere in a vast internal post-restant waiting revivification, but it contributes nothing in the way of meaning or wishful fantasy to the formation of the screen memory. That comes entirely from the later adolescent or adult experience. And to take his example of the point of contact, his example is the taking of the flowers, which existed only as a brutally literal gesture between children, waiting for its figurative meaning to be conferred on it in retrospect, by the adult fantasy, being absorbed into the order of signifiers as a symbolic act of deflowering at a later point. However, if it had no pre-existing personal significance for the small flower thief, for the child, why was it recorded at all? And in the form of a scene in a narrative with its own dramatis personae, in excess of the requirements of the colonizing adult fantasy. Why was it there waiting? In other words, a prior process of selection would have had to taken place for that memory to be available in the first place. In order for it to be organized and encoded in the form of a scene in a narrative, however partial and enigmatic it might be, a prior selection was necessary, not just of this particular memory rather than of others, but also of these sensory elements in the memory, that is to say, the vividness of the yellow flowers, the delicious taste of the bread. Why those sensory experiences out of the manifold of sensory data that had constituted this moment of experience? And by ignoring this prior selection and the reasons for it, Freud's defense of its genuineness takes place at the expense of its meaningfulness. It's real, but it doesn't have any meaning of its own until it's retrospectively donated meaning. And that leaves as an open question, well, why was this memory in such nuanced detail retained and recorded, awaiting reuse, unless it has some psychic punch, some phantasmatic power of its own? Now, one of the puzzling things about the screen memory essay is the partial disconnection of the schematic model of screen memory. That is to say, Freud offers us three models of a screen memory. There's the regressive screen memory, in which later experiences regress back to available childhood memories and rework them and are screened off by the childhood memories. There is contemporary screen memory, as in the schematic AB example, where the screening element and what is screened by it are contemporary with each other. Okay, so there appears there to be no obvious temporal structure. And then Freud allows the theoretical possibility of what he calls a progressive screen memory, in which an early childhood experience, which was in some sense excessive, unassimilated, right, is then represented by a later and disguised by, screened off by, a later experience, which in some sense frames it, sublimates it, contains it, domesticates it in some way, manages it, if you like, in some way. So he offers you these three models based on three different relationships to time. But in none of his work on screen memories, whether in this essay, which is dealing with a regressive screen memory, nor in the chapter on screen memories in his book, The Psychopathology of Everyday Life, where he goes back to the topic of screen memories, where the analysis he offers us is of two contemporary elements in the same field of experience. So he nowhere offers us an analysis of a progressive screen memory, and it's precisely the progressive screen memory that recapitulates the model of trauma again. That is to say, of some moment of original inscription that is excessive, unintegratable, disabling even, disabling in its sense of something in excess, which then is lying there in wait for reactivation and retranscription, retranslation, if you like, in a later moment. So, as it were, it's just around the corner. And Freud nowhere addresses this this relationship of screen memory to the question of trauma. But it's kind of there. The question's there to be asked, so to speak. And very interestingly, the essay ends up with a sort of skepticism, if you like, about all childhood memories. Do we have any childhood memories that are simply transparent photographic records of a real event that we can simply sort of like pick up off the shelf of memory? Say, ah, yes, that's it. And there's this missing consideration of the notion of progressive screen memory that would have taken him explicitly in the direction of the trauma theory. So, but with his generalized skepticism about the claims of memory, if memories are childhood memories we're talking about here, childhood memories are all a question of a conflict of mental forces, their compromise, and therefore the exclusion and screening out of some key element in them. We are a long way then from we end up a long way to the question of trauma and its relationship to memory. I would end up with this rather interesting statement he makes, that maybe we only have memories of childhood, but we don't have any memories that are simply from childhood. In a sense, having started off with this unusual set of experiences, puzzling, enigmatic, without emotional significance, but very vivid, why should they have been retained in memory? Freud ends up making this kind of parabola whereby he ends up saying that becomes the model for all childhood memories. Though we have this generalized phenomenon that he calls childhood amnesia, nevertheless, he says, everything that was of emotional significance, despite its erasure from the conscious archives of memory, is somehow or other inscribed in enigmatic form in one of these screen memories. Okay, so we get this kind of simultaneous, this rewriting of the notion of both memory and forgetting. In some sense, nothing's ever forgotten. It's inscribed in some form. Nothing that was emotionally significant, I should say, was never forgotten. It's inscribed in some form. On the other hand, nothing ever is ever remembered either. Right? In other words, both terms of the opposition, memory and forgetting, are under erasure or in inverted commas. Okay, so we're following on the question of screen memories and the different kinds of screen memories and how we might, what status to give them in relation to the more general process of memory. Okay. And the 1899 paper on screen memories, it both resumes, but it also, oddly enough, frustratingly, silences the sort of theoretical conflicts and disturbances that agitated Freud in the 1890s around the whole question of the seduction theory. It's kind of replayed in that between Freud the analyst and Freud the analysand, and the different positions they take up about the relationship between the early childhood memory material and the later adolescent and early adult fantasy. And that resumes those arguments that obsessed Freud all through the 1890s. Except at the same time, it's a kind of missed encounter, and a strange kind of theoretical amnesia seems to overtake Freud in that essay, because, well, there are two signs of it. One is the odd fact that at the beginning, where he's talking about the survey done by the two French psychologists, the Henrys, and they cite two figures who replied to their questionnaire about earliest memories, and there's the early memory of one of them, which Freud sees as being clearly very likely to be a sexual memory of breaking a branch on a tree, pulling a branch off a tree or something, where it in French, and he raises the question of whether this would be the so in German, or was it the other way around? It's more the other way around, actually. In German, the phrase pulling one out, or what is it, something like that, is obviously a slang term for masturbation. And Freud says, well, you know, raises the question of whether this would be the case, whether that would work in French as well. And the fact that somebody else is there helping him do it on his memory of this scene. And then would raise the question of seduction, right? And this is something that Freud had been kind of, it's very obvious when you read through the Fleece letters, he's endlessly full of anecdotes from his patients involving scenes exactly like that. And he doesn't for a minute raise that question or think about, you know, is this a memory? Yes, fine, it's probably got a sexual subtext to it, but is this a memory trace of an infantile seduction of a child of a certain age by an older figure or something? It's not even raised. So it's striking by its absence. And the other thing that's striking by its absence is the very category that he invents at the end. He makes the distinction between different types of screen memories, regressive or retrogressive screen memories and progressive screen memories. and then contemporary screen memories, where the screen is an early memory masking or covering over a later fantasy, or the other way around. And he says, well, actually, progressive screen memories are the most common ones, but he never analyzes such a one, which is really odd. So he posits this category of the progressive screen memory, which would rhyme exactly with the model of traumatic seduction, of some excessive, exciting, disturbing, early infantile experience, which then repeats in the form, in a disguised form, covered over or screened out by later fantasies or later material of some kind. Nowhere does Freud analyze such a screen memory. Whenever he returns to the question, he always talks about regressive screen memories and sometimes contemporary screen memories. So again, it's a very strange kind of absence, or what I'm calling a sort of theoretical amnesia, as if he leads us to the very point where addressing that issue, which is a leftover issue from the seduction theory, and then he sort of, and then it vanishes in his thought. It leaves a kind of space that can't be filled. Now we see the same thing happening in the Leonardo instance. Leonardo is a much more complex and richer case study. It's not just focused on this one element of the memory, though it's central to it, but it's an attempt to give an account of a whole artistic personality, the shape of a life, in effect, and to give an analysis of some of the one or two of the great paintings produced by Leonardo. And, you know, his way into that is through this memory of Leonardo's, ostensibly a childhood scene. There is this odd oscillation between what starts out as being, his perspective is very much that of a retrogressive screen memory. After all, here is this marvelous scene that Leonardo claims as a memory, as a literal memory, which is just scrawled in the margin of one of Leonardo's manuscripts. It's really rather fascinating. And the manuscript is a scientific manuscript, a scientific discussion of how birds fly. And he does a detailed analysis of the mechanics of flight in birds. And the bird, in fact, he's particularly interested in is the kite, which, in fact, is what the memory is about, even though Freud mistranslates it as vulture. And there's a whole lot to be said about that mistranslation. But at the moment, anyway, in the middle of this very, very precise, very detailed scientific discourse with drawings and, you know, it's very, very rigorous piece of writing on Leonardo's part as a naturalist, observing and then, as it were, dismantling the bird's wings and how do they work in flight, etc., etc. Written, scrawled in the margin, is this memory of being visited in the cradle by a bird, and the bird thrust its tail into his mouth and beat about inside his mouth, and he feels that this meant that he was destined to write about. It was inscribed in his destiny because of this event in his childhood that he would write about and be concerned with the bird, the kite, and with the problems of flight. So it's as if in the middle of this quite rigorous scientific discourse, suddenly there is this personal myth of how I was singled out. I was chosen in this miraculous, almost supernatural way, and my destiny was inscribed in me from the beginning. And of course, Freud's response to that is to say, obviously this didn't happen. It couldn't happen like that. So though he does have a footnote where he kind of thinks, you know, well, maybe a bird could it possibly be, you know, some kind of bird flew down, etc. But basically, in the first section or so of the case study, his position is this is a fantasy that has been projected backward into Leonardo's childhood, and so it's a retrogressive or regressive screen memory. And so that fits in with every time he talks about screen memories, it's back projection. But in the course of the case study, that whole model shifts. Indeed, it kind of ends up being stood on its head. And in effect, Freud's very, very complex and detailed analysis, both of the childhood memory of the bird visiting the infant in the cradle, And everything that Freud draws out of that and relates to other areas of Leonardo's life and work, in effect, without saying so, without explicitly labeling it, in effect analyzes Leonardo's memory as a progressive screen memory. And quite explicitly, the thematic of seduction is consciously brought into his argument. So in an interesting way, in 1910, when he's writing the Leonardo case study, the whole question of seduction is put on the agenda. The inscription of an intense and excessive eroticized experience for the infant, which then has later consequences. Before I go into that in any details, then I want to trace this strange oscillation in Freud, and there's a sort of version of this. It's not quite the same as in Leonardo. In the little mini essay on Goethe and on this one memory of Goethe's, in the Leonardo case study, Freud doesn't mention the term screen memories. Right? He doesn't. So he's clearly operating with a version of that concept, but he doesn't use the word, the formulation. Then in 1917, I think it is, 7 years after the publication of it in a new edition, he then writes a footnote. No, I'm wrong, it's 1919. He writes a footnote about the Goethe example, which he had just written up and published in 1917 on Goethe's childhood memory. And he's making the connection between the Goethe and the Leonardo. In fact, he's identifying them. He collapses the two together in the footnote. And in the footnote, he kind of rewrites the account he had earlier given of the Goethe memory. So there's a lot going on here, and it's kind of difficult at first to sort of track it down. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the Goethe passage, because it's slightly easier to get one's mind around it. Okay, let me just read out the text of the memory, so to speak. This is the opening page of the Goethe essay. Three brothers, the von Ochsensteins by name, who lived over the way, became very fond of me. They were orphan sons of the late magistrate, and they took an interest in me and used to tease me in all sorts of ways. My people used to like to tell of all kinds of pranks in which these men, otherwise of a serious and retiring disposition, used to encourage me. I will quote only one of these exploits. The crockery fair was just over, and not only had the kitchen been fitted up from it with what would have been needed for some time to come, but miniature utensils of the same sort had been brought for us children to play with. One fine afternoon, when all was quiet in the house, I was playing with my dishes and pots in the hall. And since this seemed to lead to nothing, it's a very odd thing to say, since this seemed to lead to nothing, I threw a plate into the street and was overjoyed to see it go to bits so merrily. The von Ochsensteins, who saw how delighted I was and how joyfully I clapped my little hands, called out, "Do it again!" I did not hesitate to sling out a pot onto the paving stones, and then, as they kept crying, another, one after another, of all my little dishes, cooking pots and pans. My neighbours continued to show their approval, and I was highly delighted to be amusing them. But my stock was all used up, and still they cried, "Another!" So I ran off straight into the kitchen and fetched the earthenware plates, which made an even finer show as they smashed to bits. And thus I ran backwards and forwards, bringing one plate after another as I could reach them in turn from the dresser. And as they were not content with that, I hurled every piece of crockery I could get hold of to the same destruction. Only later did someone come and interfere and put a stop to it all. The damage was done, and to make up for so much broken earthenware, there was at least an amusing story, which the rascals who had been its instigators enjoyed to the end of their lives, unquote. So that's the memory. And it sort of fits in with Freud's initial description of those strange subcategory of memories which we remember with great tenacity and vividness and in great detail, and which seem to have no particular reason for being recalled. This is the only memory from his earliest childhood that Goethe appears to have, and that he writes about in his autobiography. And yet there's no particular rationale for it. Why remember that rather than something else? In particular, why not remember, more emotionally more significant, more important experiences from childhood? Why remember that? And there's something arbitrary. It's as arbitrary as it is vivid and as it is detailed. And Freud sort of is interested in it, puts it aside, wondering what sense to make of it. And then he has a case study of a man who has a very similar experience from his childhood, and he wonders about the connection between the two. And then he asks his colleagues, who, and they produce a couple of other experiences. So he's starting to get a kind of group, and then gradually that kind of pattern emerges as not uncommon. Now, he says very soon after that, he gives us the term in this essay, screen memory, but he makes a distinction that he then forgets or loses, and it's a really important distinction between different kinds of memory. So I'll read that out. That's on page 225 of Goethe. He says, "The high value of such childish recollections was, it is true, obvious only in a few cases. Generally, they seemed indifferent, worthless even, and remained at first incomprehensible. Just these memories, why just these memories should have resisted amnesia? Nor would the person who had preserved them for long years as part of their own store of memories see more in them than any stranger to whom he might relate them. Before their significance could be appreciated, a certain work of interpretation was necessary. This interpretation either showed that their content required to be replaced by some other content," that's the first one, okay, that their content needed to be replaced by some other content, "or they revealed that they were related to some other unmistakably important experiences and had appeared in their place as what are known as screen memories." Now, that's quite an important distinction. Okay, one is, it's a distinction, if you like, between memory as content and memory as process. Okay, in the first one, there's a memory, but to understand it, you have to make a substitution of what's been remembered. It's standing in for something else. Okay, but in the second one, and you might easily just elide the two together, as Freud does when he writes his footnote into the Leonardo paper. The second one is the substitution it takes place in the process of memory itself. It's focusing on the process of memory formation, okay? And it's in that process that a substitution takes place, okay? To elaborate on that, in one example, you have a very clear, transparent memory of an event in the past. But to understand that event, you have to realize that a symbolic substitution has already taken place. The substitution takes place in the past. Whereas in the screen memory, which I'm calling memory as process, it's in the process of the memory formation that the substitution takes place. Okay? In the first one, then, it's a question of there being a single scene, but the significance of that scene can only be reached by an interpretive substitution, because the scene is a scene of substitution, if you like. Okay. Whereas in the second one, the substitution takes place between two different scenes as the memory is being formed. So the structure of the second one is very like that time structure between an earlier scene and a later scene, in which one stands in for the other, substitutes for the other. But in which its emotional burden, if you like, is being transferred onto the second scene. And it doesn't matter at this point which is early and which is late. It's just that it's got this temporal structure of two scenes and substitution of one scene for the other, whether it's forward or backwards. At this point, is not the point. Whereas in the first possibility, it's a single scene, right, that's being remembered. And the substitution there is one that's been performed by the figure in the scene. In other words, in this case, by the child who smashes all the crockery and throws it out the door. Okay. Whereas the substitution in the second one is being performed by the person, the adult, who is doing the remembering. Okay. Now, by that token, Freud's interpretation that he gives us, and I find it a very persuasive interpretation of the Goethe childhood scene, it's not a screen memory, okay? Because there's only one scene, and the assumption is that this is a clearly remembered scene, it's an accurately remembered scene, okay? But to understand it, you have to understand what was the child doing in throwing all these things out the door onto the street. And Freud is puzzled by that. It seems emotionally charged. And then particularly when he puts it in a group with the memories produced by other patients. Now, the other patients give a kind of clue. that their memories of doing something similar, taking household objects and hurling them out of windows or out of doors, cups, jars, you know, father's heavy mountaineering boots, whatever. At a certain point, this angry child takes all this stuff and hurls it out. And in all those cases, it's correlated with the birth of a younger sibling. The child in question is 3 to 4, and remembers quite explicitly being really angry on that occasion, and is able to make a correlation themselves between the birth of a younger sibling. And Freud makes the very plausible suggestion that what's at stake here is a symbolic action or a magical action, in which the unwanted child has been thrown out, okay. And the smashing expresses anger. But as he says, the dimension of out, of being thrown out of the house, expelled, is absolutely crucial to the meaning of this gesture, of this action that the child is performing. Okay? But there's no question that the memory is an inaccurate or made-up memory. Okay? The assumption is that this is a transparent, almost mental photograph or film reel of the event that happened. And so it is to do with the anger and maybe even murderousness of sibling rivalry. And Freud, in fact, tracks down through the Goethe family history that extraordinary list of siblings who'd all died at 6 months or 12 months or whatever. One wonders whether the great Goethe had been kind of a serial infanticide, killing off his younger siblings. But the one that this is focused on, little Hermann Jakob, actually survived longer than most of his siblings. He survived to the age of 6, and he died when Goethe was 10. And Freud interprets this as being as something that's formed out of early material. No, that's right. Freud takes that as an accurate representation. He says, you know, Goethe, like the Up My Patience, is arguably trying to get rid of this this sibling interloper who will distract his mother and will be a rival for her affection and her attentions, etc. And indeed, there is a recorded memory, not from Goethe, that he was reproached by a family friend, that he was reproached by his mother, that he seemed indifferent to his brother's death, indeed rather annoyed at this family fuss about the death of his brother. And his mother actually reproached him with having no feelings for his brother. And he then rushes off and pulls out from under the bed all these drawings and things he'd written down, which he said he'd written in order to teach his brother. Freud's interpretation, interestingly, however, it's got something of the structure of a regressive memory, because he says that the train of thought that one can infer as Goethe is remembering his childhood, and is that you know, he was born nearly dead and was revived, he was his mother's favourite, and no rival lasted long enough to dispute that place with him. And so it's a kind of triumph or Schadenfreude, a kind of pleasure in defeating and in the failure of the other rival, as it were, and that secured his place in his mother's affections and his sense of himself as one who triumphs and succeeds at things. I mean, that itself is interesting, because it then is saying that train of thought is very much an adult train of thought. Okay. And so at the end of his reading, Freud seems then to be inserting something like the driving force behind this memory is his sense of adult triumph, but also perhaps guilt at his hostility to his brother and his pleasure when his brother died. So a mixture there of, on the one hand, guilt about how he had felt about his brother and his brother's death. On the other hand, a kind of Schadenfreude and a triumph. And so one might think, oh, well, maybe Freud's positioning this essay, this memory as a regressive screen memory. But he doesn't at any point attempt to analyse in any detail the process of memory formation. He takes the assumption that what happened as Goethe remembered it. And what's the point of interpretation is the significance of the symbolic or magical substitution that the child performs at that point in its life when faced with a rival. However, And so, on the whole, because he assumes the memory is transparent and unproblematic, you know, it doesn't count as a screen memory, according to Freud's distinction and his criteria. However, there are aspects of the memory itself that might call that into question, as that is so often the case. The material Freud recalls often gives us clues and information that enable us to think, to interrogate Freud's interpretation of the material. And here I'd point out that fact that we talked about in seminars last week, that detail in the memory text where he's talking about the way he's being encouraged by the von Ochsenstein brothers. The von Ochsensteins, who saw how delighted I was and how joyfully I clapped my little hands. That should kind of ring a bell, okay? Here we've got the case of, that he talks about at the end of the 1899 paper, okay, of the recollecting ego looking back and seeing its earlier self, right, as a child acting in a scene. And my little hands, that's the gaze, the backward gaze of the adult, right? Children don't see themselves as having, oh, look at my little child's hands, right? They think of adults as having great big hands. You know, they don't think of themselves. To think of yourself in those terms is to see yourself from a later adult's perspective. So that's calling out, this is a screen memory, okay? This is being revised, re-edited, reconstructed, okay? It's not simply, as Freud assumes, a transparent, veridical record of a real event. And the more you think about it, the more I think that becomes obvious. You know, we're talking here about a kind of, an haute bourgeois, respectable German family in the mid to late 18th century, and how the son of the family basically trashes the entire dining service of the house, right? Hurls it out the front door and smashes it all. There's no sign of the parents coming in and of anger, of, you know, there's no way they're going to be cool about this, okay? So there's this complete absence of parental response. The parents are written out of the story, and there's no anger and there's no punishment. In fact, there are these adults in the story, and they're the instigators, he says. They're the ones who started it all, right? So this wonderful shifting of blame, even though in the narrative he says, you know, I was sitting there in the corridor and as it didn't seem to anything, I just thought I'd hurl something out into the street. And then they saw me and then they encouraged me. So even in the narrative itself, there's that discrepancy. But a clear shifting of blame and a clear absence of parental disapproval, parental anger or parental punishment, and this kind of happy ever after ending of, oh, we would recall this story and say, you know, well, these sorts of things happened, and, you know, wasn't it fun, or wasn't it, what a lark, etc. So, I mean, the more you look at the story, the more it is highly edited, highly idealized, you know, etc. And I say the little hands detail, I think, gives the whole thing away. Someone might say, in fact, that actually, there was perhaps a rather different scene took place that may well have involved the kind of magical throwing out, aggressive and angry magical throwing out of household items that represented the young rival. But actually it had a very different emotional texture to it and ended rather differently from the way it's portrayed. In other words, what we have is a genuine screen memory which has been filtered and recomposed in the process of memory formation, okay? So it's not just a question of saying the child is performing a symbolic substitution and taking out its anger on, can't take out its anger on the newborn baby, takes out its anger on household objects, as it were, smashes up the house insofar as it can at the age of 3 3/4, okay? But in the very process of forming that memory, there are signs in the text of the memory. So there's then an ambiguity here around how Freud addresses the question of screen memories and the way, as it were, the text of the memory eludes his own categorization of it. And it's not an identical thing, but there's also an ambiguity about Leonardo, that is to say, the whole question of the way in which Leonardo's memory seems to call out, that this is obviously a made-up memory, this can't be a real, literal memory. And so Freud's first go at it in the opening pages of his case study is that this is a back projection into childhood of a later memory, as it were, even though the scene is one of childhood. So it's like almost as if at that point in his text he's thinking of it as an equivalent to the screen memory, his screen memory of the meadow and the flowers and the bread, in which later adult issues are being smuggled into a childhood scene and at once disguised and expressed. But actually that emphasis in Leonardo changes, and I want to talk about, say a bit about that. Now, I'm labouring this question because what's missing, and yet what is the text, as it were, cries out for, is this precisely this category of progressive screen memories that arguably come into play in some way with the Goethe essay. That is to say, he is at a later date managing his guilt and his triumph over his brother in his adult memorization and writing up of his autobiography. But it also is never named, but it becomes the conceptual structure of Freud's interpretation of Leonardo. So a kind of a reverse moment starts to happen, and I just want to talk about that. Yes, one of the questions I think that's important is not just early and late, and identifying material as belonging to early experience or the later revision of early experience, or the way in which something that looks like later experience is highly charged with something that might point in a different direction, okay, and identifying, as it were, dating the material. There's also the question of the motivating force behind the formation of screen memories. What is the pressure that's driving the formation of the memory, okay? A pressure that won't let up and that requires expression but at the same time is intolerable and requires management and to some extent binding and disguising. And that's been the structure in the Emma case, in the case of Miss Lucy R, in those early trauma cases that we looked at. So Freud starts with this proposition that Leonardo's is a fantasy formed at a later date transposed to his childhood. Yet, despite this, he performs a series of translations, interpretive translations, of the scene with the bird, decomposing it into a layered structure of one scene upon another, each with its own specific meaning and signification. So it's a kind of palimpsest, it's a scenic palimpsest in which one scene is imposed on top of another scene, imposed on top of another scene, and all highly condensed, rather like the process of the dream work. One could almost say, one could formulate the notion of a memory work in which memory is formed and driven by the play of condensation and displacement, just as dreams are. And of course, in the structure of the dream, as in the structure of the trauma, what's at stake is the priority of the infantile, the priority of the archaic in terms of personal psychic history, as in the dream, where the capitalist of the dream, what funds the formation of the dream, is in fact this excessive and intense and repressed childhood scene, wish, fantasy, that is then transposed onto what Freud calls the day's residues and gets played out by proxy or in disguise behind the day's residues. But the priority of the dream formation is to do with that priority of the infantile, and in most of his dealings with the notion of screen memory, because he's always insisting on regressive screen memory, it precisely inverts the dream model and the trauma model. Yet it's haunted by the trauma model. The seduction theory or the trauma theory haunts these later texts of Freud. Now, I want to say a little bit about the different layered translations that he makes of the bird memory and the sort of temporal complexity, if you like, that's there. Now, the first translation that Freud performs on the special language of the bird memory focuses on the bird's tail. I quote, "A tail, in Italian, coda, is one of the most familiar symbols and substitutive expressions for the male organ in Italian, no less than in other languages. The intrusive," unquote, "the intrusive, even aggressive activity of the bird's tail signifies a specific sexual act." And Freud suggests, and I quote Freud again, the situation in the fantasy of a vulture opening the child's mouth and beating about inside it vigorously with its tail corresponds to the idea of an act of fellatio, a sexual act in which a penis is put in the mouth of the person involved, unquote. Freud doesn't attempt to explore this fantasy in its own right. He just labels it a passive homosexual fantasy. And in order to preempt his readers' anticipated disgust and indignation, attributing such a thing to a great genius like Leonardo, the divine Vinci, Freud passes very rapidly on to assert the general incidence of this fantasy and to trace it back to, quote, an origin of the most innocent kind. It only repeats in a different form a situation in which we all once felt comfortable when we were still in our suckling days and took our mother's or wet nurse's nipple into our mouth and sucked at it. So in addition to transforming this, quote, loathsome homosexual fantasy, unquote, into an innocent and comfortable scene, a scene, he calls it, of human beauty, one that is given common artistic and religious sanction, he remarks, by so many representations of the Madonna and child, and indeed it's precisely the Madonna and child, that paintings that Freud will go on to analyse. Freud also has given the fantasy a psychobiological foundation. He calls it the organic impression of this experience, the first source of pleasure in our life, and it doubtless remains indelibly imprinted on us. So behind the fantasy of fellatio, and Freud, interestingly, Freud doesn't claim it's a memory of any kind, he just assumes it's a fantasy, lies its originary reminiscence. Quote, what the fantasy conceals is merely a reminiscence of sucking, being suckled at the mother's breast, which is presumably why Leonardo's encounter with the bird takes place in a cradle, and not, as its homosexual content might warrant, perhaps, in a scene from later life. However, if the scene of intimate, even aggressive intrusion, conflates a later adult or adolescent fantasy with an indelible infantile reminiscence of oral pleasure, which is Freud's argument, his location of its infantile origin leaves certain questions postponed or even unanswered. What is postponed is the general account, which he gives later on, of male homosexuality, supposedly arising from a particular fixation on an identification with the mother, thus allowing Freud's reduction of homosexuality to its maternal origins. But what is unanswered, what isn't even asked, is the question, in this fantasy, whose penis is being sucked? If the infant's partner in the original scene, according to Freud, is his mother, even a phallic mother, and the fantasy of the phallic mother is elaborated by psychoanalysis and is quite common, then in what sense could you call it a homosexual fantasy, okay, if the originary partner is the mother, the phallic mother? If it is a homosexual fantasy, then what hidden or elided male figure, bearer of the intrusive penis, is the active partner in this passive homosexual fantasy that Freud identifies, labels, but does not explore? One might wonder, for instance, about the possibility of a disguised memory trace of sexual abuse of the child Leonardo at some earlier age. This is exactly what Freud, material that Freud wrote about and was faced with all through the 1890s. But again, it's silenced, it's absent, it's not there at all. The question is never posed. Okay. Now, at this point in Freud's analysis, it might look as if, once again, the temporal structure of the fantasy is the familiar one of a retrogressive screen memory, in which a later homosexual fantasy, a scene of oral sex between Leonardo and a male partner, is being disguised in an innocent, if enigmatic, childhood scene. Is Leonardo's memory, then, merely a homosexual variant of Freud's 1899 memory of the field, the flowers, and the bread? And it is different because Freud has given the scene a universal origin. Okay, it's a universal scene of origins, something we have all experienced, whose mythological and ontological importance centres on the figure of the mother. In identifying the bird as a representative of the mother, Freud in effect reverses the regressive logic of the screen memory by revealing behind the later homosexual fantasy an even earlier archaic memory of being suckled at the breast. This is the earliest organising scene, though it itself then it has to be unpacked, and Freud does unpack it in different scenarios. So at this point, the model, the explanatory model, is reversed 180 degrees. Okay, the regressive screen memory turns out, in fact, to be a progressive screen memory. Something exciting, excessive at the origins. And the question is, why should this been represented in if it was merely a commonplace, near-universal experience of all children suckling at the breast, why did it need to be translated into the symbolism of the vulture, as he thinks at that point it is? And I should say something about the vulture translation or mistranslation. The Italian is Nibbio, which very clearly means it's not a vulture, it's a kite. A lot of the German texts that Freud read, in fact, mistranslated as vulture. However, as Laplanche points out in his commentary, Freud read Italian perfectly well. He spent most of his holidays in Italy. He was a fluent Italian speaker, and indeed in our very text that we're reading, he quotes the Italian commentaries in Italian and then gives us an English translation in the footnotes. So Freud read Italian. He knew Italian. Okay. Now, he may not have been an ornithologist, and so there may have been a little vagueness about the specialised subspecies of different birds. But Laplanche's argument is actually this is is not an innocent mistake on Freud's part, put it that way. And it's enabled in the German linguistically because of the closeness of the two terms in German. The German term for vulture is Geier. I wanted to write that on the board. G-E-I-E-R, Geier. But one of the various, there's more than one German term for kite, is Hungeier, chicken vulture. Okay? H-U-H-N-G-E-I-E-R. So you can see how there's a linguistic connection that would have enabled a slide to take place. However, the motivation for the attraction to Freud of the idea of the vulture is that symbolically the vulture signifies a female figure. Why does it signify a female figure? Well, he goes into a whole Egyptological excursus, which is kind of fascinating, but really slightly beside the point. Not least because, as he admits, the Egyptian hieroglyphs weren't translated until the French Egyptologist Champollion in the early 19th century, and so Leonardo would not have known what Egyptian hieroglyphs were about. However, he does point out that legends about the vulture were talked about by the church fathers, that the vulture as a strange kind of species of which there were only females. There were no male vultures. And the females conceived by opening their vaginas to the wind, and they were impregnated by the wind. Okay, so the vulture then becomes this interesting symbolic figure. For the church fathers, they were interested in this fable because they took it as as natural history, and therefore seemed to indicate the natural possibility of a virgin birth. And Leonardo would have read that and would have been familiar with that. He was very learned, and of course he endlessly paints the Madonna and the Madonna and Child. And that gives us the connection, as it were, and why the whole Egyptological thing is in a way a kind of irrelevance, but also why it's a sort of substitution. That what's at stake here is not Egyptian mythology of the mother, but Christian and specifically Catholic mythology of the Virgin Mother. Okay, we don't need the goddess Mut and all that stuff to see that what's at stake here is a culturally sanctioned fantasy about the sacred single mother, Mary, okay, and the Christ child. So the significance, if there is the Christian tradition, a linkage between the vulture as an example of the single mother in nature who conceives without a man, and then it's pointing towards the religious fantasy that sanctions and legitimizes. But also, Freud wants to argue, of personal importance to Leonardo because it signals his personal situation as the bastard child of Sir Piero da Vinci and a local peasant girl, Caterina. And we know very little about, we know a little bit more than Freud knew, but even so, the biographical records of Leonardo is very thin. We know that he was alive at five and living in his grandfather's house in the town of Vinci as an illegitimate child. very soon after he was born, his father marries a woman of his own class, Donna Albiera. And he makes the reasonable inference that even though Italian society and culture in those days are pretty cool about illegitimate children, it's very unlikely that the new bride would have been presented with the bastard child of the man she just married. Okay, and so he infers that, you know, at some later point when their marriage turned out to be childless, that little Leonardo would have been adopted into the paternal house, and so he would have given up his mother Caterina, his first mother, and had a second mother, Donna Albiera. And that becomes important in Freud's reading of the paintings which aren't just ordinary Madonna and child scenes. They are St. Anne, the mother of Mary, and Mary and the child. And indeed, the double inscription of the maternal figure is important in both scenes because of the ways in which Mary is sitting on, though she's an adult woman, is sitting on her mother's lap. Okay. And in one, she's holding the Christ child, and in the other, he's down on the ground, and she's trying to catch him, as he looks as if he's strangling a lamb, or playing aggressively, shall we say, with a lamb, and she's trying to kind of catch him and withhold him in some way. So the double registration of the maternal figure in the paintings is related back by Freud to the biographical circumstances of Leonardo. But the particular argument he wants to make is that... as well as experiencing this close relationship to the mother, he experiences the absence of the father, that he too was a vulture child. And he grew up aware of the absence of the father. Okay, and this becomes very... there's a lot of things to be said about that, but this becomes very interesting and very important for Freud, where he's unpacking another one of the layers of this childhood scene or memory. Because as well as being suckled at the breast, he infers the presence of an intensity, an intrusive erotic intensity to do with the mouth. And so he infers the scene of a kind of kiss, of an intense eroticized kissing of the mouth. And indeed, the two, if you like, the two symbolic images that are crucial in Leonardo's oeuvre is the mouth, the smiling mouth, the Leonardo smile, and the bird. And they're never found together, which is very interesting. The bird, whether it's a kite or a vulture, is in fact bound up with this split in Leonardo between science and art. And the puzzle that the enigma of Leonardo for Freud, this great painter who abandoned his paintings halfway through, who was also a great scientific intelligence, who studied things and discovered things that were barely recognizable. Like he's a Copernican hero, of course, for Freud. You know, the remark that he writes in one of his diaries, Il sole si muove, the sun doesn't move. We move around the sun rather than the sun comes up in the morning and goes down. So he works out himself a Copernican perspective. So he becomes a kind of intellectual Copernican hero figure for Freud. And what fascinates Freud and what is this problem he worries away at through the text are these two different sublimations of that infantile scene. A sublimation into intellectual activity, into the investigative drive, which expresses itself in these extraordinary scientific manuscripts, which were centuries ahead of their time, and which he never published, you know, which were only published, you know, way after his death, in which he discovered how extraordinary things, you know, the presence that parts of Italy were once under the sea due to the rock formations in the Arno Valley, and you know, amazing kinds of scientific intelligence that he has. It starts off that he, you know, starts dissecting bodies on the quiet and trying to find out about how bodies work, in order to be able to paint. But intellectual obsession, takes over, and finally it takes him longer and longer and longer and longer to paint because he's off trying to work out the physics of the objects he's painting. So you get this very interesting split between what Freud sees as rival sublimations, the sublimation of that original infantile scene bound with the mother and the excessive eroticization of the child by the mother, who makes him into her little husband, under the heading of the bird, which is the symbol or signifier of the sublimation into investigation and latterly scientific analysis and investigation, and the smile, the mouth, the intensely invested mouth, the sight of suckling and kissing, which signals, which is the signifier of painting and his artistic ability. And there's this struggle between these two different sublimations that Freud is trying to sort of decode and understand. And at the heart of it is this return to the problematic of seduction. Okay, and that has... I haven't got time. I had hoped to be able to read out the passage, but I haven't got time. But we can look at it in class. In section 4, where he elaborates the eroticized nature of the mother-infant scene, we get this extraordinary turning around of the standard Freudian Oedipal model, right? With the re-emergence of seduction, we get a kind of inversion, a bouleversement, a turning over of the Oedipal paradigm. One could say from a Ptolemaic to a Copernican version of the Oedipus, okay? And he's done very eloquently and very rapidly, just in a paragraph, it's almost as if Freud doesn't really understand the radical implications of what he's saying. And that very section ends up, again, with what I've called a sort of prose poem celebrating perverse male sexuality, male femininity in the figures of Bacchus and St. John, the paintings of Bacchus and St. John. Okay. I mean, Freud is in love with them. Freud is completely seduced and fascinated, entranced, fixated, I'd almost say, by the figure of Leonardo and by these two late paintings of the Bacchus and of St. John. And he writes this extraordinary lyrical prose celebration of male effeminacy, quite astonishing. So Leonardo does some very odd things to Freud. It kind of stands Freud on his head. It pushes him to the limit, right? Leonardo seduces Freud, and it has some rather interesting effects on Freud's theory.